listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. I know that both of our distinguished writers tonight are ardent supporters of the Los Angeles Public Library. Attica Locke, who is interviewing Walter Mosley tonight, serves on the board of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Walter Mosley is a recipient of the LAPL Literary Award. And in the spring of 2011, receiving that award, Walter Mosley noted, quote, "Knowledge is not so much in quantity, but in the quality of access, not in a test score, but in a freely active mind and the concert of active minds that come together under one roof. That roof is the Los Angeles Public Library, and it is the shining beacon for the hope we have of making it out of the cold." Amen, Walter. I think it's a pretty stunning statement. Walter Mosley is the author of more than three dozen award-winning books ranging in genre from the crime novel to literary fiction, nonfiction, political essay, science fiction, young adult, and erotic fiction. For those of you who are already fans, you can rejoice because there are two new Walter Mosley books to look forward to in the coming months. Debbie Doesn't Do It Anymore, a novel about a black porn queen whose tomcatting husband dies in a hot tub, will be released in a few months, and the next E.Z. Rollins mystery, Rose Gold, will be released in the fall. Mosley's novel, Devil in a Blue Dress, kicked off his series revolving around the iconic and immortal detective Ezekiel E.Z. Rollins, a resident of Watts in Los Angeles. Rollins' continuing story begins in 1948, and with the 2013 release of his 12th story, Little Green, has progressed to 1967, where we find him investigating the dark side of LA's 1960s hippie haven, the Sunset Strip. Mosley's Rollins novel together form, as David Ulan has noted, an extended social fiction, as much Balzac as Raymond Chandler, charting the life of Los Angeles and its overlapping layers of race and class, which makes him the perfect choice, I think, to open this conference. Among Mr. Mosley's many, many honors, he is the recipient of the Penn USA's Lifetime Achievement Award. Attica Locke worked as a screenwriter for many years and was a fellow at Sundance Institute's Feature Filmmakers Lab. As the New York Times rightly noted, Attica is, quote, "a dazzling writer with a conscience." Or, as Dennis Lehane noted, "I'd probably read the phone book if her name was on the spine." Her first novel, Blackwater Rising, was nominated for an Edgar Award as well as a Los Angeles Times Book Prize. And her second book, The Cutting Season, is a stunning murder mystery set at a restored plantation on the Mississippi River where the past and the present uneasily coexist, where giddy brides and grooms exchange wedding vows, and a troupe of actors perform a scripted reenactment of the plantation's role in the Civil War. The Cutting Season was recently awarded the Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence, and recently Attica wrote the introduction for the UK publication of Ernest Gaines' classic book, A Lesson Before Dying. It is a great honor. Please join me in welcoming Walter Mosley and Attica Locke to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
I guess we're live, huh?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, yes.
Well, okay, Mr. Mosley, we have been tasked with a broad array of things to talk about, writing in and of California, race, noir, all of it. And I want to start with that last bit, this concept of what constitutes noir. So Isabel Allende got into a little bit of trouble. I don't know if you heard this last week, where her latest novel, a mystery called Ripper, she said she wrote as a joke and that she does not read the genre or really have much respect for it. And there are a lot of mystery fans that went kind of crazy. Now, I have heard that you hate being called a mystery writer. And first, I'm curious if that's true.
No, not at all.
And why do you think that's gotten out there that you...
Well, because I don't want to only be called a mystery writer. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like I remember once I was in the library... New York Public Library, and there I was standing there with Toni Morrison and a woman that we both knew, and then another woman walked up, and I guess the other woman was like from Mars or Venus or something. And so she said, my friend says, well, this is Toni Morrison, the novelist. You know, mm-hmm. said hello. And she goes, this is Walter Mosley, the mystery writer. And I said, well, I'm a novelist. And she went, yes, mystery writer. And I went, no, novelist. Mystery writer. It was so funny. She wouldn't she wouldn't let it go. And so that's the thing, you know, the idea that, you know, I mean, I love writing it in all kinds of genres. I'm also mm-hmm. a science fiction writer and a writer of erotica. I write short stories. I write all kinds of stuff. And
but that
all
is
those
one that sticks. I mean, I've been
well, that's
given
okay.
the
you know,
the
if you have a big butt,
well.
Some people like it, you know. I mean, but that doesn't mean that
it's
that's you.
It's a very loyal fan base. It's a very loyal.
No, it's true, you know. They like my butt. That's good, you know. It's good. I mean, you know, I don't mind. You know, so yeah, man, I like that butt. All right, fine. But I have a head and two arms, and like I can't just be a butt, you know.
Do you draw a distinction then between mystery and noir? Would you consider those overlapping or two separate things?
Noir is always kind of like a film term to me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's kind of the way the camera works, the way the shadow works, the way the mood is. And I suppose you can make noir music and noir novels. Mm-hmm. And those noir novels don't necessarily have to be mysteries. Mm-hmm. You know, there it might be, you know, I mean, a woman planning to kill mm-hmm. her husband.
I think of George Pelicanos as being noir, but not necessarily neatly fitting into the mystery.
Yeah, I think so. Often, sometimes it's crime, definitely crime. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there's mystery fiction, there's crime fiction, there's noir fiction. Sometimes they're all three together. Sometimes they're separate. You know, there's a thing that when you really get into it, you know, there are cozies. There's all kinds of different writing, and you know, and a lot of people just want to. You know, in England they call it crime fiction. Period.
Yeah,
and that's nice.
Which I actually think is a better moniker for the genre.
But you know, but it's too bad to you know to a, you know see I know that if you come from a certain you know background like Ayanda, who's a wonderful writer, but she comes from a background where there's a hierarchy of literature, mm-hmm. a thought of a hierarchy of literature, and so you know to you know if somebody would call you a mystery writer, you'd be insulted. Well, mm-hmm. you know, well you know, and. But, you know, we know that you can write really bad literary fiction. All you have to do is go in a bookstore and look at the, you know, new books and say, wow, this is really bad, you know. Who wrote this? What did the New York Times say? Damn. And then you read this mystery over here and say, God, this is really good. There's also really good science fiction. Almost nobody believes that. You know, Samuel Delaney is one of the best writers in America.
Yeah.
You know, but nobody's going to, you know, going to recognize that because that's bad fiction. You know, it's bad.
Yeah, it's the propensity to constantly and consistently label things, which actually leads nicely into what I want to talk about next. So you live in New York now, yeah? But everybody kind of considers you, or at least I think a lot of people consider you an LA author, a man mm-hmm. of Los Angeles. And frankly, in my opinion, you have a life story that could only have happened in Los Angeles post-World War II. Which is you have a Jewish mother, mm-hmm. The child of Russian emigres, and a black father from Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
So are you, how comfortable are you talking to us about how your upbringing has deeply, or not deeply, affected the stories that you're telling?
I'm completely comfortable. Is that the question? I'm answering the first question, if I'm comfortable. I say I'm really comfortable here.
Comfortable, yes.
I'm going to stick my hand down my pants, you know. Me and Al Bundy. Well, you know, it's so interesting. You know, the other day, I was invited to a house with 11 other people, all of whom were biracial. The house is on 81st Street. Anybody knows, like, you know, in New York, if somebody owns a house on 81st Street, at one point, the lady, who's very nice, she said, well, you know, I'm wealthy, you know. I lived in Toronto, but on weekends, we took the family jet to Aruba. I was like, wow, the family jet, you know. We had a family dog. Couldn't get it to Aruba, but. And we were talking about being biracial. Hmm. Which I thought was kind of interesting, you know, and I was very clear, you know, like people say, well, how's it feel being both white and black? And I said, my father's black, my mother's Jewish. There's no white in there. people who get
I'm
most.
I'm from Texas. I understand that because that's how they think in Texas.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah. Say, well, a white. Well, that's a Jew. There ain't no white.
Catholic, you know. Too. They'll give you some stuff on Catholic.
Catholics, yeah. You know. I mean, I said, like, don't you know your European history? Don't you know you weren't white over there? You know, but you know, they forget that stuff, you know. And anyway, so, and I, some people argued with me about that, but I wouldn't listen. I said, you know, you have to shut up because it's my turn. But there were people born in the 50s. I was the oldest person in the room. It was so upsetting to me. The 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. There was a
born in the 90s.
Yeah, 17-year-old girl was there, and a boy who was 15. And really, for every generation or every decade after mine, people were more and more upset. Like, they were confused. Like, am I white? Am I black? Am I alive? Am I dead? I don't know. And it was amazing, you know, and really, I'm making fun, but I don't really mean to make fun of them. But, you know, if you were born in the 50s, you were black, you know. Nobody, them, it's like, I'm light-skinned. Well, he's light-skinned, you know. He got some good hair, but he black. He a nigga just like me, man, you know that. You know, and so there wasn't a thing, like, I didn't feel like I didn't belong, because it's the only place I could be. I was with black people, and it was fine, and everybody accepted it.
Yeah.
Say, no, you got, you know, you could pass, you know. And, you know, but, I mean, it was just a thing, you would say it, but it didn't mean anything. I was black. My father said, I said, Dad, what am I? I said, black. I asked, once asked my father, I said, Dad, I figured it out. Everybody in the world is black, except Mom and the people on the television. And he said, no, Walter, no. And, you know, that was it. That's all he had to say, that tone of voice of my father. So, like, you know, so maybe I didn't answer your question.
You didn't, and I don't care. I mean, that was fantastic, so.
Okay. Because, you know.
But like, what I was starting to get at is, in my opinion, there's the theme of diaspora runs deeply throughout your work.
Mm-hmm.
And so you are doubly the child of diaspora.
Yeah.
Being that your mother is a product of diaspora, and then your father of the great African-American migration. And so I'm curious how much you are consciously wearing that on you when you first kind of sat down to begin a life as a writer, that if you felt like you were taking on a role as historian or that there was something to document, that if it was in your conscious mind to speak to some of these themes.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I it's not like I was... I had a plan. I'm from Los Angeles, and I'm black, you know, I mean, in some kind of metaphorical way. And I knew that we, black people in Los Angeles, is some of the most important part of Los Angeles history, and certainly Los Angeles culture. You know, just like, you know, many Japanese and Chinese and Mexican and other Latino people have such a big impact, but we have had no real presence in the literature.
Mm-hmm.
And because we didn't have a presence in the literature, we didn't exist, because nobody reads history, you know? I mean, very few people write good history, and they aren't read either. So, like, you know, it's really awful. And so my idea was to write that history of these people that I love, you know. And certainly they're Mexicans and Jews and all kinds of people who show up in the literature because, you know, we live in a world, you know, with other people, like a lot of people's fiction doesn't know. And so what we do is, you know, I wanted to write that. That's a political notion, not quite as like developed as the one that you're suggesting, but that was and from that, you know, notion, you know, grows
And let me ask you the question that people ask me all the time: why did it show up in the particular genre of mystery, at least the first novels? Why do you think?
Well,
we talked about this a little bit at dinner.
We did? Oh, okay. I forget.
We talked about your wild background.
Yeah.
And my straight and narrow background.
Well, I was curious. Both of our attitudes toward a wild background is what we talked about.
Yes.
But what was the question?
You're going to make me realize I probably forgot it.
Good.
We were talking, we might have to move on. Because I actually literally...
Maybe your daughter remembers.
Maybe she remembers. Yeah. Oh, yes, why did it show up as, thank you, why did it show up as
you,
mystery? Man. Why did it show up for you?
I wrote a book called Gone Fishing,
mm-hmm.
which is about two late teenage black men in southern Texas and maybe a little bit in Louisiana, in a mythical town of Pariah, Texas. They're coming to their adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent the book out, and people sent letters back. This is really good writing, but this is not a commercial novel. And I finally figured out what they meant. What they meant was that white people don't like black people, black women don't like black men, and black men don't read, so who's going to read your book?
You have just explained my sales figures for the last four quarters. Thank you.
And so, you know, I mean, like, so there I am, you know, and I said, well, okay, you know, because, you know, listen, you know, Malamud wrote a whole bunch of books before he got published, you
mm-hmm.
know. I think The Natural's first thing he got published, you know, and that's because it was about baseball. And I wrote another book, same two characters, Easy and Mouse,
mm-hmm.
and it was called Devil in a Blue Dress. And by halfway through, I said, you know, this is kind of like a mystery, you know, that's kind of interesting. And I finished writing it, and I gave it to an editor. And he liked it. I gave it to an agent. She liked mm-hmm. it. She gave it to the editor. He said, I'll publish it if you, you know, rewrite it. And I did, you know, and it was great, you know.
So you stumbled into, in some ways, into that genre.
Yeah, I just stumbled into it, you know, and then, you know, I said, well, this is nice. I like writing mysteries. You know, I don't only write mysteries. You know, that's not the only thing I'm going to do, but I like doing it. It was fun.
What happened the first book that wasn't a mystery that you had to share? What was the publisher's reaction? If you'd gotten this great niche going, and we're having these great sales, and people loved your butt.
Oh, they,
as you
no,
said.
They were.
What
they,
happened
they,
when you first showed up was something that was not.
Oh, they were very upset. They mm-hmm. finally got rid of me. You know, I mean, from that publisher, they finally kicked me out. You know, and I gave, you know, I gave this book, you know, because I said, well, can we do Gone Fishing? They said, well, maybe if we do a collection of your books, we could use that as an introduction. You know, and I went, really? It's like a whole novel? It could be an introduction? I said, we'll have to cut it down a little bit, but you know, and so I said, oh, listen. And I gave it to, you know, Paul Coates mm-hmm. from Baltimore, Black Classic Press, and that was great. I published that, you know. I think that, like, some people think that you're going to get rich writing, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. especially the publisher. They think they're going to get rich on your writing. And the idea is, like, if you want to get rich, you buy real estate. You're from L.A., you know. You buy an apartment building. You rent out some units, you know. You hire the marshal to kick people out when they don't pay the rent, you know. You raise the rent, you know. And that's what you do. And so, I mean, I'm going to write books, you know. I mean, if you're writing books, if you're not writing from your heart, they're not going to be good books. And if you are writing from your heart, they may not be what people expect.
Yeah, no, that is
you know?
True.
And so, you know, so I write a lot of different kinds of books. I write, as we were talking before, very fast. I think I've published 46 books now.
Yeah.
And, you know, and... Well, only if they're good is that good, but... But you know, I love writing, and a lot of times, you know, publishers don't like... And I have to change publish. Every time they get mad, I got to change publisher. You know, I'll go here because they don't want to publish erotica, or I'll go here because they don't want to publish science fiction, you know.
But can I ask you, as a new kid on the block, is that kind of inner confidence of saying, well, if this is not working here, I kind of know what I did, and I'm going to go find a different house for it. Did you always have that? Or has that come from 40-something books?
No. I always had it because, you know, it's like, you know, really... Well, you know, I started writing late. I started mm-hmm. writing when I was in my mid-30s, got my first book published when I was 38. So in many respects, I was already a failure. And, you know, once you're a failure in life, you're always a failure in life. You never become a success. Like, you know, it's like, you know, so I already was, you know, like, I already was who I was.
Yeah.
You know, so like somebody, you know, like, if you're young and you're very successful, you know, you want to hold on to what you got. You know, and, you know, I'm like, well, you know. That, you know, what Joe Louis said to his friend who was his trainer, he said, man, you know, Joe, you better be putting some money away. And he said, well, you remember those jobs we had at the docks loading up them ships? He said, yeah. I said, they still got them jobs for us, man. You know? Like, you know, you have to think like that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, as a writer, you're not gonna connect with your heart. And if you don't connect with your heart, you're not going to connect with your people, your world.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
I want to talk a lot. Or talk some about the latest book, Little Green,
okay.
which I love. There for me, and if you will allow me to comment a little before I lead up to a question, for me there's a great theme of resurrection in this book. Mm-hmm. And there's literal resurrection,
right,
because E.Z. Rollins went off a cliff and he's okay. But that's page one, so I'm not giving anything away. But there's also for me something kind of behind the resurrection. There's another theme to me about that generation who left the South and came to a place like Los Angeles, who had seen the absolute worst that America had to offer them, mm-hmm, and had lived it and survived it and come out on the other side. There's a great line in the book where E.Z. is on Sunset Strip talking to this hippie girl, and she's talking about a whorehouse. And she's, you know, saying it's work. It's no different than working in a factory. It's, mm-hmm, no different than being on the line. And he says, or in the cotton fields.
Yeah.
And I got my dad here, and my dad, who picked cotton as a child, always says whatever he's doing was not picking cotton.
Yeah, right.
So this can't be that bad. So for me, there's...
You mean I could make money, fucker? I don't have to be in this goddamn cotton field? Damn. I could imagine that's what I would think. It's hard picking cotton, right? It, like, it cuts up your hands and shit, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's,
yeah,
really bad. You but got blood in my cotton, boy.
But for people who survived that and came out on the other side, to me, in that resurrection is a kind of fearlessness in the freedom that they could find. And I don't know if that was conscious or your part. You might not even see that. I do want to read a short passage from the book. You with me?
I'm here. As long as I don't have to read it,
you
I'm
do
fine.
Not have to read it, sir.
Damn.
This is easy talking. My mind was filled with images and imagings about life before and after the car crash. I was thinking about sharecroppers again, those small-bodied, powerful men and women who dragged bulging sacks up to 5 times their size across fields of cotton. This image seemed the appropriate metaphor for my life. That huge sack was my house, my car, my job hunting down a boy I never met. Rather than a burden, this weight, this millstone, was my chance at deliverance. If I could survive that labor, then my rest would be deserved. I think that is incredibly beautiful.
It sounds nice.
It sounds nice.
I like that.
But it speaks to holding on to an agrarian memory in this new land, yeah, of California.
Yeah, well, that's easy, yeah.
And so I guess this might all just be a comment on my part to say I love that. But what I found in it is a kind of, if you lived through all that and you arrived here, it makes me think that the black people who arrived here, what they were able to do and create and add to the culture, as you said, came from, you done lived through the worst of the worst that this, mm-hmm, country has. And you are free now. Yeah. You are free to really kind of achieve something grand.
And that's what people thought. I mean, you know, they said, man, you can go to California, eat off the trees, sleep,
right,
on the,
right,
street. Man, it's good out there. Wasn't that good? But just even the dream of it, even if it wasn't true, it was kind of wonderful. You know, you could come out and get, like, my father's like, man, I got 3 jobs, you know. Sounds like someone, you know, in Living Color. Said, I got 3 jobs. Said, in the morning I do this, at night I do that. On the weekend I'm a painter. You know, and it's like, you know, and I bought my own house, you know, and,
yeah,
and it's really like all these things that you couldn't do, you,
yeah,
know. I mean, there were dangers, of course, you know, but, you know, I mean.
And there's a, my sister and I have talked about this before, about the, somebody needs to study the difference between the black people who left and the black people who stayed. And, mm-hmm, their different kind of experience. Because I come from people who stayed. Mm-hmm. And I come from people who never left Texas.
Political activists who stayed.
Political activists who stayed.
It's like, that's worse. That, I mean, like, that's like, that's more than staying.
That's more than staying. That's like getting in it. That's like getting in it. And I think it's just a different kind of experience. But if you will allow me, I want to run through another little piece of the book about Mr. Chester Himes.
Okay. Oh,
I love that you call him out. So Chester Himes is beautiful noir crime fiction writer from the, when did he start, in the 40s? Did he start?
Yeah, I think it's the 40s, yeah.
So you got two guys in here comparing Cotton Comes to Harlem with Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. And so the character, Jackson, says, I think that Himes is equal to Ellison. You compare Cotton to Invisible Man? Not just that, Jackson countered. Chester got 13 other books and still counting. Ellison is good, but you know the word masterpiece comes from painting. So, there ain't never been an artist in history ever painted just one painting and had it called a masterpiece. You gotta do a lot of work, get experience before you can say something like that. I like Ralph's book, but I think it's Chester get down to where the shit stinks. Ellison made a window that the white man could look into. But it's Chester made a door so we could have a way out of the burning house. Now, what's fascinating to me about this is that Toni Morrison and Junot Diaz just sat down at the New York Public Library maybe 2 months ago, and she said something very similar to what you just said.
She must have read my book.
She must have read your book.
Oh.
She said, invisible to whom?
Mm. Yeah, right.
You know, yeah. What do you mean by that? And so it leads me to ask, so for her, she brought that into a larger conversation about who are the intended audiences that we're all thinking about. And for her, it was a danger in presuming a white audience. And I'm curious how much you have a fixed idea of an audience, your audience, in your mind. Does it have a color? Does it have a gender?
My audience, I know very well that my audience shifts. Like, for instance, when I wrote R.L.'s Dream, really, the main character is Soup Spoon Wise, but right there with him is Kiki Waters. And Kiki is a white woman who was really severely sexually and otherwise physically abused as a child by her father and her home. And when I was traveling around the South, only white women journalists were interviewing me. Hmm. And they all said, I know somebody just like that. But the way they said it didn't sound like, you know, it sounded like they know them in the mirror, you know. And it was like, it was a book that they loved, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a very important book to them, you know. I remember in the opposite, when I wrote Always Outnumbered, Always Outgunned, a lot of white male journalists would say to me, you know, I don't think I can forgive Socrates for what he did. And I would answer gleefully, Socrates doesn't care what you think. You know, that's not on his list, man.
Yeah.
You know, and so you're like different people read books for different reasons at different times. You know, and for me to worry about that, my worry is to write the best possible book that for me sings. One of the things in at least my first 20 books, I read the book out loud into a tape recorder somewhere around the sixth or seventh
draft.
Yeah, draft. Where you can actually hear it. Mm-hmm. You know, because a novel should be a musical experience.
Do you think that's a black thing?
I don't. I think that if it is, you know, that's too bad for white people and other people. You know, because, you know, like, all books are music. All people's language, you know, sings. I mean, the Irish, man.
Yeah. I mean, I ask that because I feel like I'm always trying to catch. My narrator for me feels like somebody, like, sitting at a bar, let me tell you the story. Mm-hmm. And it's very oral to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I approach it much more from that point of view than thinking about high literature. I'm just trying to catch voice and...
But, you know, I mean, high literature is that. I mean, James Joyce is that, you know. I mean, Charles Dickens or Mark Twain or Herman Melville.
True.
I mean, you know, I was once in a writing workshop very early in my career, and a woman said, well, you know, you have all this dialect. You shouldn't have, good literature doesn't have dialect. And the teacher turned to her and said, so you think Huckleberry Finn is a bad book, you know? And she
went,
Oh, well, white dialect is, I guess, okay, you know. Because we know he's smart enough to, you know. But,
right,
you know,
right.
But, you know, of course.
I had an experience like that when I, with my first book, that I was writing in a black Southern vernacular. And there was a fear for me that people would think I could not speak the Queen's English. That I just...
Oh, and a lot of them don't. But, you know, that's okay, you know, I mean... And really, honestly, a lot of people, you know, you only, if one person out of every 1,000 people in America buys your book, you have a runaway bestseller.
That's true.
So 999
true.
People can hate your book, and just one of them likes it, and you're great. You're doing good, you know? There's a thing, like, you know, we worry about things which aren't really true. Everybody doesn't have to love us, you know?
Yeah.
Most people don't have to love us. Well, only black people want to buy your book. And I said, man, there's millions of black people. Shit. That's fine with me. Somebody say, well, you know, you can't write that gay literature, you know, because, you know, then only gay people will buy your book. Say, man, I'm going to outsell you, you know. Your mother going to buy my book, you know.
Oh, my God. So you are not then burdening yourself with the task of speaking to either or and black or white America. You don't feel a kind of burden of speaking to a particular audience.
Well, the truth is that every time somebody reads your book, it's a different book. People make up your
That's
book.
True.
People, if somebody is smarter than me and they read my book, they think smarter things than I think. It's true. I've had people come up to me and say things that are actually true about the book, but I would never have thought of it because I'm not smart enough. And I go, wow, yeah, uh-huh, you know. It's okay, you know, because genius is a cultural thing, you know.
Yeah.
It's not a singular thing. You know, Mozart, yeah, but without you know, language around him, without people around him, without a history of music, there's no Mozart. You know, I mean, we make it up together.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's just true.
Well, let me ask you this. Particularly with this book, because EC's grown, he almost died, he's older, and you write in the past tense, and there are times where it feels that I can almost picture, I'm curious if you have EZ fixed somewhere in your mind when he's telling these stories. Is he still in California? Is he a particular age in your mind from which he's narrating?
Yeah, he's old. He's old and he's remembering.
And you don't have to give it all up.
Yeah,
you don't
want to give it he's all old up. And he's remembering.
Yeah.
You know, and that way, you know, because every novel you write, you know, you could be writing about ancient Rome, but you're writing, if you're writing today, you're writing for people today. You're not writing for people in ancient Rome. They look at it and go, what the hell is this? You know, damn, the pages turn. Wow.
It's paper.
That's so strange.
Is he in California when he's telling these stories?
I think he might be, yeah, because, I mean, I think he feels anchored in L.A. You know, like a lot of people, they came here and it was just so great. I ain't going nowhere, no ever again, you know.
Well, so, I like knowing that he's an old man.
Yeah.
That means if he falls off another cliff, I'll know that.
Yeah, that's right.
He lived to tell it.
Well,
so
why, change.
Mr. Mosley, why did you leave California?
I don't like driving.
that's
honestly
a pretty good reason.
I don't like driving. I didn't like driving when it was easy to drive in L.A. You know, when I could get from one place to the next, you know. And now, man, my God, you know. And like, you know, I really, my whole life, my family came from New York, you know. Like my mother's family, they all wanted the sun, and you know. But I had the sun every day forever, you know. And so I wanted to be in New York. You know, I was wanted to be in New York. And you know, I love it there, you know. But, you know, I'm still a California boy. I mean, even there, you know. Like, I don't act like I'm from New York. You know, they accept me, they like me, you know.
In
but
what
they say,
ways?
You different though, man. You different. Why you?
But in what ways? In what ways does your California show?
Well, actually, starting to be a writer in your mid-30s.
Yeah, well, that's.
Yeah, like that all by itself. You know, I think the way I explain California, California is where the 80-year-old woman finally retires from her job. And you say, well, what are you going to do now? I said, well, I'm thinking about taking up ballet. You know,
yes.
I'm very nimble.
Yes, I can, yes.
You know.
Yes. And she will have five people saying, that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's California. That is true.
And then she has the concert. And you go to...
Yes.
And you go, I'm having that concert tonight.
That's true. That's true. Whereas you're right, New York can have... So that leads me to a question about how your writing, whether it's about California or not, has shifted between the two spaces. They're very different. And in my opinion, you know... New York makes me very sleepy, and I get overstimulated and overwhelmed. I don't think I could string together two sentences in Manhattan. So I'm curious how writing is different there versus here.
Well, you know, writing's not different anywhere. I write every day, three hours a day.
How many
maybe hours? About 360 days a year. There's only about 5 days I have to give up for one reason or another. But you know, almost every day. 360 days a year, I write 3 hours every morning, no matter where I am. And it's like, it doesn't matter if it's in New York or if it's in L.A. or it's, you know, like I'm in, you know, Columbus, Ohio, waiting to do a reading somewhere. I just, you know, get up and you do the reading, because the writing is what's important, you know. Because writing is like all art is unconscious activity. People who want to be an artist and they feel that they can't, it's because you're thinking that it's conscious. You're thinking that, you know, that Tolstoy wrote War and Peace word for word and never went back and changed anything. You know, no, he changed it many, 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 many times. And if you write every day, it's like psychoanalysis. What happens is that other 21 hours, your unconscious is working. Mm-hmm. And then when you come back to it the next day, there's new stuff. If you skip a day, it's hard to get back, and you skip 2 days, you have to start over again. You know,
you wrote about this in the New York Times.
Yeah,
you said about ideas being fragile and needing to write, needing love every day. You said these ideas have no physical form; They are smoky concepts liable to disappear at the slightest disturbance. An alarm clock or a ringing telephone will dispel a new character. Answering the call will erase a chapter from the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it took me a minute to come to that. I use different language. For me, it is, I feel like when I'm in a book, I'm in a relationship. And it feels to me that I wouldn't go a day without speaking to my husband. Because mm-hmm. how are you going to have a relationship if you're not checking in every single day? And so I feel the same way, that time away from the book, it's too much work to find where you were in it.
Yeah.
Again, you waste a lot of time that way. And there's no promise you will find your way back to where you left off.
Yeah, it'll be somewhere else.
Yeah. And it's heartening. You
Somebody
said
else's husband. What's your name? Ralph? Oh.
But what's heartening about what you said in the New York Times that I think a lot of newer writers don't understand is that having that kind of daily relationship with the work might look different every day, and that's okay.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, every day is not going to be 10 pages.
Well, it doesn't matter. Like, yeah. It doesn't matter how much you write. What matters is that you address, you know, the novel,
mm-hmm.
and or you know whatever you're writing, and or painting or whatever you're doing. You know, it's like as long as you address it, then your mind comes alive to it, and all those things in your unconscious, this vast space,
yeah.
like a universe, these lights start twinkling on and off, and they start vibrating, and they start talking to each other, separate from you. And then as time goes on, when you come back to it, new things are there.
Yeah.
Other concepts have come together, ideas have resolved themselves. You know.
I had a later question for you, but I'll bring it up now, which is these 46 books, and help me understand how that happens in a man's lifetime. I mean, I'm hearing it with this 3 hours every day, but I'm also mm-hmm. curious. You said 5 days here or there in the year you're tasked with doing something else and you can't. But has there ever been a life change or some kind of thing that happened that fundamentally disrupted that for you? And how did you get past that? Or has it really been consistent through marriages, divorces, deaths, moving here, change of jobs? Has it always been there?
Yeah, I mean, really, I think that the worst period of my life was when my father died. And I wrote every day then.
Hmm.
You know, because, I mean, really, it was one way to connect with my father. You know, my father was a wonderful writer. But, I mean, you know, he came from a time and a place where he couldn't make it real. He couldn't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
And his stories, you know, my father could tell you, like, a dumb story that you would still laugh your ass off at. You'd be so upset at yourself. Why am I laughing at this stupid shit? But he was just so funny, you know. And he was, you know, and he was also very manipulative in his stories, you know, which I also kind of love, you know, because, you know, part of the things is we manipulate people's emotions,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so, I just kept on writing. I mean, I could imagine that something might happen, make me stop, but it hasn't, you know.
No, then I think it's here. Mm. I think it's probably here to stay. Did your father live to see your first book published?
Yeah. I won an award in England.
Oh,
we went together,
man.
And he went with me. And I went to this thing, and we were standing, like, ready to go in, and a guy came up and said, Mr. Mosley? And I turned and said, yes. He goes, no, not you, your father. my friend Joe from, like, New York, you know, the guy you met. I was oh, yeah. He told me to say hello to you. You know? I was like, wow, my dad, you know, it's very cool.
So I want to switch a little bit and talk about your experiences with Hollywood, and particularly mm-hmm. the adaptation of your work. So the first one was Devil in a Blue Dress. How involved were you in that process, the script, the casting, the any of it?
Well, you know, the notion of doing a movie is kind of like that thing of working with smoke, you know, because they, whoever they are, buy it. And then they own it,
mm-hmm.
you know. And they don't really, I mean, they listen to what you say. You say, well, how about if you know, do him? So, well, okay, fine, we can do him. Why don't you give us a couple of million? And we'll do that, you know. I mean, you buy into this, you know, because otherwise, you know, shut up, you know.
Yeah.
And so the notion is that you have to choose very well the original people, who's going to produce it,
mm-hmm.
who's going to direct it,
mm-hmm.
who's going to write it. And if you can be a part of making that decision, make the deal with those people in place,
mm-hmm.
then pretty much you're going to have an okay film, or you have a good shot at having an
mm-hmm.
okay film. And that's what happened with Devil. You know, Carl Franklin was writer and director. Jonathan Demme was mm-hmm. producer. And
yeah, that's a great team.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and they, you know,
who
and
wrote
it was black.
It?
Huh?
Who wrote it?
Carl Franklin wrote it, and he did a very good job. He would call me up and ask me questions, but I was really smart. He said, "Walter, I'm going to do this. What do you think?" I said, "Oh, that's a good idea. I think." I never disagreed with Carl once. I don't think I've ever noticed it, but you know, like, I didn't know. Like, I mean, I don't know how to, and then, yeah. then I don't know how to make movies. I'm like, what's I'm going to do? You know, I'm like, I'm going to make it. I know a lot of people think they do because they watch movies. Like, I mean, everybody watches television, right? But all you have to do is one day sit down and think about that show you just watched and figure out how did they write that? Because it's really difficult.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with how you experience it, you know. And so, and I knew that, you know, because I was writing books, and that was hard enough. I didn't even know how I was doing that, and so, like, I certainly wasn't going to do it with movies, and that worked well. Then I wrote Always Outnumbered, and Michael Apted directed it. We did it at HBO, a very good place to make anything, and that movie, you know, Lawrence Fishburne said he'd star in it, and he was wonderful. He's great on the set. He's a great actor. But even better than that, he's great on the set. He makes everybody happy, makes everybody feel comfortable, and you know. And so that we had a great experience doing that, and it was a really good movie. The guy who was the head of HBO at the time came to me, and he said, Walter, I just want to tell you how happy you made me. He's not the head of Time Warner. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, I've been working a long time, and my father has never been happy with anything I ever did. He called me last night, and he said, you know that movie? I saw Devil, and Always Outnumbered. I saw it on your... Station said, you know, you finally did something okay.
That's high praise.
It was great. I said, damn, that's really good.
So after the movie's over, it keeps going. I'm curious, your characters have kept going.
Yeah.
So does it get in your head? I mean, Mouse looks nothing.
Like,
Don Cheadle does not look like Mouse.
Right.
So is that now, like, messing with your what's in your head?
No.
You don't see Denzel coming to you in a dream about...
I know there are people in here who do.
Direction.
You know, I know there are people in here who do. But if I have those dreams, I'm not going to admit to that. But as far as my books are concerned, no. You're skipping over all these pages.
No,
I like that.
Moving. But we're gonna get to the people. Right? Yep. Did that. Mm-hmm. Oh, let me ask a couple of quirky craft questions.
Uh-huh.
I think people like to hear, and I'm also curious. For you in particular, naming characters.
Yeah.
Is that instantaneous for you, or do you have to reach for it? And do you think it is possible for you to know a character before he or she is named? Because names are such a big deal in what you write.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that I have to name them. You know, my producing partner Diane over there and I—we were running around doing this pitch with the wonderful rapper Common, trying to do a show called Mr. In Between. Mm. It's based on a short story I wrote, and the story, you know, starts out a guy asks, you know, the main character who delivers messages to people, you know, kind of messages that you don't want anybody to hear. And he said, well, you know, what should I call you? He said, well, you can call me Master because that's my name, Master Vincent. He said, you know, you could call me Mr. Vincent, you know, if you want to be more formal. But, you know, like the whole notion that, you know, because his mother, you know, he's from the South, you know, so they named him Master so people couldn't disrespect him. You want to call me by my first name? Fine. My first name is Master. Master, how do I get in this refrigerator? You know that's how you play. You call Mouse. Say yeah, right. You call him Mouse.
Right,
he's
a, right.
But
and
don't,
he's
but
a
don't
tough
think that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't. Yeah.
What comes for you first? Character, a setting, a line of dialogue.
Usually a line of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Be it prose or dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually it's a line that comes. You know. But you know sometimes I have a character in mind. I have a name. When I was working with Socrates lately, I came up with the name Billy Psalms, and I just love that name,
mm-hmm.
Billy Psalms, the gambler. that's perfect. You know, I don't know what it means, but it's perfect. His name sounds like he's not too tall. You know that?
No, I mean, and I find that I have to reach more for names a little bit, and I feel like I don't really know who the person is mm-hmm. until I completely know their name. And for me, it's all about where they were born. It was all, I need, you know.
I don't completely know who they are until the third or fourth book. You know, so like, you know, like I'm still discovering things about Socrates, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, damn, really? Wow. You know? And so, Miles, you know, that whole discussion with Easy and Jackson about Himes, you know, like, I didn't really know, I didn't know they had it in them.
You know?
You know? And there are things Ma says, man, I would never think of on my own.
That's the unconscious, though. That's the unconscious.
Yes. I said, wow, shoot, you know. What you going to do to him? Oh.
So you are not a naturally violent man.
I don't think so. I don't think so, you know. But, you know, you just think of what people do. You know, for a long time I was a nighttime custodian. Not a long time, a couple of years. At the Los Angeles Unified School District, I go to schools at night and we clean them out in more ways than one. And and there was a guy I worked with named Eddie. I was like 19 or 18. Eddie's like 21. And Eddie's like looking at me one day. He's just looking at me. And I'm a little uncomfortable. I said, man, what you looking at? He said, you know, Walter, I like you. Which made me a little uncomfortable. And I said, yeah. And he said, but you know, man, if somebody offered me $1,800 to kill you, you'd be dead. Now, I don't know why he needed $1,800. Or why the wish fulfillment of getting that $1,800 was killing me. But I told him, I said, nobody wants me dead that bad, you know, so, you know, and we went on. But, you know, that you have these experiences in life. There are people who are very, you know, violent, you know, and they tell violent, you know, stories.
But you and I, when we were at dinner, we were talking about your time on the road, dropping in on communes, hitchhiking across the country, and I was thinking these are all things I would never, ever do. And I was thinking that I feel like my fascination with crime comes from my fear. It's literally just me playing out everything I'm terrified of. And it seems like that you have come across some characters that kind of led you into the darker side.
I'm scared. You know, like, you know, I'm scared all the time. Shoot, you know, like, you ever like walk, you know, walk in there and the bus comes by and you almost stepped in the street, you know? I mean, really, it doesn't have to be, you know, violence, like somebody mad at you, you know, like people die all the time, terribly and ridiculously, you know? It's like, they just do, you know, like, yeah, they're just following their own path. They end up dead, you know? Yeah, I walked here, went there, and then all of a sudden the ground came out from under me. I wanted to catch on, but you know, and then they're dead. You know, I mean, you know, that's kind of like, you know, that's what life is about. Yeah, you know, we're mortals. Mortal means we're going to die, you know, and we live in a place, you know, like, I mean, really, they tell me the police are better in Los Angeles now. I've had at least 5 LA cops pull guns on me. And believe me, I've never done anything for somebody to pull a gun on me ever. You know, I mean, but like, you know, they pull a gun on me and like, it's like, you know, warning me and threatening me and trying to make me confess to things. I mean, and you know, I mean, but there was a thing, you know, part of it was being high for most of my young life.
I was going to leave that part out.
Yeah. But it was all kind of like distant, you know, you'd see it, you know, go, wow, that man had a gun on me. Damn. that was some crazy shit right there. I think I'm going to go over to Chris's house and see what she thinks. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you're just living, you know, you're living life. And like you say, it's, you're not in the cotton fields, you know? I mean, damn, you know, you're not in prison. There's a kind of an agony and a pain and a suffering, which is day to day and forever. You know, sometimes somebody black will come up to me and say, you know, like in the 20th century, a black man walk up to me in Detroit. I say, how's it going? He said, man, it's tough on a black man in Detroit. And I said, well, I understand what you're talking about, brother. You know, in the 21st century, I go to the same place, and I say, you know, I say, well, how's it going, brother? He said, man, it's tough on a black man in Detroit. And I say, I know what you're talking about, brother, but you know, there's a dude in Kandahar be happy to do an apartment swap with us.
Woo! You're not
people
lying.
In Kiev say, damn, I'd trade places with you, black man, you know? It's like, you know, there's, you know, sometimes we forget how lucky we are, you know. Mm. You're waking up in the morning, you know, you just had sex with somebody wonderful, you're going to have some nice whiskey, and then you've got 3 jobs, and, you know, things are good. You bought a house, you know, you got 2 wives, you know, they don't know about each other, you know. There are people living all kinds of lives, you know, and you don't know, you don't. And you can complain, you can get upset, you know, that somebody mistook Sam Jackson for somebody else. You know, I mean, But that's Sam Jackson's problem. He took care of it. He took care of it. It's over now. He said, that man is never going to do that again. And a whole bunch of other people learned that not to do that again, you know? And it's like, but, you know, to say, well, you know, this is an attack on me. Well, it kind of is. Yeah, I understand that. But also, you know, we're so lucky to be alive, you know. We're so lucky to be breathing. We're so lucky, you know, to have those moments behind us. And, you know, I think that, you know, when Easy is talking about his life, you know, he's thinking that. He's saying, that was something. Yeah, you know, Jackson Blue was a great friend. Mouse was a great friend, you know.
Yeah.
I have children that I raised. I have children that I found in the street that, you know, have taken care of me. You know, there are things that are so beautiful in life. And that's what I'm writing about. And I think that, you know, in most of my books, these people are very happy. I'm not sad. You know, if you ask Langston Hughes, they say, why are white people so upset with black people? Because they just don't know how beautiful it is to be colored. You know, I mean, shit, you know, I mean, who we are, who we were, who we were raised with, that's a beautiful thing. These are beautiful people. It was a wonderful life. And you know, just because somebody else, you know, tried to make it hard, that's okay. They just made it better, really.
That is a beautiful place to open it up. So we have some questions.
I appreciate many things you've written, and I have a question, but I wanted to share with Gone Fishing, there's an image that sticks in the mind where the boys are way up country, and they go in this woman's house, and they can't get in the house because there's so much furniture. They're like, that's the book, right? And she said, she explains she's the last one in her family, and she's inherited all this furniture, and she doesn't feel she can give it away, so she just makes a little more room. And as I get older and we inherit stuff, that image is there, like, are we going to be walking through the five couches in the living room? But my question is, Mouse died. And then Mouse came back.
Yeah.
And Mouse is very alive now.
Yeah.
But you made a decision that he would die, or Mouse decided to die, and then somebody decided he should come back. You went over a bump. Is that how?
No. Easy is the one who drove off the side of the cliff. He didn't die. He just went over the side of a cliff.
And he almost died.
And almost died. Mouse also was shot. At one point, and, you know, but he was taking the Mama Joe. Once you get to Mama Joe, you're okay, you know. Mama, if there's any possibility in the universe of fixing you, Mama Joe will do that. You know, that's the great thing. You know, you need people like that on your side. You know, and Mama Joe, Mouse, you know, Jackson Blue, John the bartender. Easy has a good crew. Etta Mae Harris, you know. Mm-hmm. You never want to mess with somebody who's with Etta Mae Harris. You know. Any other questions, notions, thoughts, ideas, minor criticisms? Oh, I can. Before I answer that question, I want to answer this first question. You can. You don't have to give it back. You can. It's gonna be. I'm gonna answer this, and then we're gonna do that. I was with my publisher. My publisher's trying to be creative. They said we're gonna, you know, we know you're Jewish, we know you're black, so what we're gonna do is we're gonna send you on a tour of Southern Jewish book festivals.
And there were, wait, how many?
There's a lot of them. There's a lot of them. Wherever there's Jews and books, there's book festivals, and so. I went to, you know, and it's great because, you know, everybody comes. They've all bought the book before they got there. They've all read the book. You know, it's great. You know, and I'm talking. But there's always, right here, three ladies. Three ladies are sitting right here. They're old ladies, and they're saying, we want to know where your mother is in that book. And, you know, and this was, I think it was Black Betty, and Easy was reading Hadrian's memoirs. And I said, well, you know, my mother, you know, was very smart, and she taught me a lot about language and da-da-da. He said, no. It's when Easy's reading Hadrian. I never knew Hadrian was Jewish, you know. And they said, that's what makes him Jewish. And I said, well, black people are smart. And they go, mm-hmm, because, you know, they know who my mother was. And so I decided I was going to make a philosopher that these ladies weren't going to claim. I just said, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make a philosopher that these ladies will not claim. And I came up with Socrates. He killed a man, raped his woman, killed her, went to 27 years in prison, and then thought to try to, you know, better himself. So I knew they wouldn't take her.
Do I need to stand up? I just had a question for you because I actually live in Watts.
And my question to you was, why Watts and not Compton? And when you write easy stories, are they your memories, or do you do some research on them?
Neither. I make it up. Honestly, that's a true answer, the last part. You know, and you know, Compton in the 50s was, you know, it was a neighborhood in transition. It wasn't a black neighborhood yet. I mean, it was becoming it. There were black people here and there, and it was slowly encroaching. But, you know, so Watts was in the 50s, you know, was where the black people, you know, and north of there in South Central is where black people, you know, congregated. So that's why I was writing about there. But they're Compton, you know. Mama Joe lives in Compton now, you know, and other people live out there. But, you know, I'm slowly, you know, spreading out those places. But no, it's true. I hate research. I really do. I hate research. I hate it. And I don't understand it. That's why I don't like reading Missionary. You know, I feel like I'm researching, you know, his novel for him. And memories, you know, like you make up stuff, you know, because, you know, that's what we do. We make up stuff. The life we live, we make up. You tell your life story to somebody, and your sister will say, uh-uh, that's not what happened.
One back here and here.
Me? Okay.
Yep.
I've heard you make that reference before to collecting apartment buildings. I guess my interest is, are your apartment buildings here in L.A., or are they in New York, or you still collect them?
No, I say if you want to get rich, you should collect them. You know, like, I want to be a writer, so I want to be poor. My father owned, like, I don't know, like 30 units in L.A., and you know, he bought, like, three different buildings, and he took care of my father could do anything, really. I mean, he could do anything when it comes to taking care of a building. My father can build a wall that won't crack. I mean, he's dead now, but my father was great at that stuff. I'm terrible at that stuff. I can't do it. But I'm just saying, if you want to get rich, you buy real estate, you don't write novels. You know, that's all.
In your Easy Rollins mysteries, you, in the beginning, it seems like you took a big gap between, like, Devil in a Blue Dress and A Red Death, and then as the series has continued, it's seemingly the window's narrowed more and more. Is there a choice or a reason that you're choosing to do that?
Well, partially my experience of the 60s and 70s is clearer to me. Mm. And there's so much political unrest and change in those periods of time, you know, where, I mean, I think the unrest is, the, you know, no greater, but the impact on America and the social organization is so fast. I mean, the hippies, I don't know if you remember, like, the hippies came out of nowhere. One day everybody had, like, short hair, you know? And the next thing, they all of a sudden, is the hair down to their ass, they're smoking dope, walking barefoot, and, you know, like, they're talking like black people, you know? I'm just like, it was wild. I mean, I was like, where'd they come from? It's like in Louisiana, you know, like, you know, they finally put a ban on killing alligators, you know, because they thought all the alligators were gone. And the next day, hundreds, thousands of giant alligators came out of nowhere. Like they heard, oh, you know, the ban is gone, man. We can come out now. It's crazy. But, you know, so, like, I'm getting closer and closer because I'm that period of time. Mm-hmm. Easy's going to be changing a lot. He's getting older, which actually, when you get old, you change more than when you're young. Mm-hmm. You know, you really start, wow, shit, I gotta do something here because it's not easy anymore. You know, no pun intended. He's going there. You go.
We've read a lot about your life, sort of in bits and pieces and articles. So, have you given any thought to writing the full autobiography so we can learn more about your wonderful father and your mother and your growing up?
No. Oh, okay. I'm not going to because I don't feel that my life is interesting, honestly. I really, my life is not, like, really. I know people who live interesting lives. You know, I was standing in a hotel lobby today, and Tony Blair walked in, you know. Not that I like Tony Blair, but he's living an interesting life. I'd like to hear the true autobiography of Tony Blair, you know. The true autobiography of Walter Mosley is like, you know, uh-huh, yeah, well, you know, it's not really all that interesting. And it would be like a kind of a job application, you know, name, telephone number, social security number, job history. You know, I noticed, Mr. Mosley, that after 1989, you didn't seem to hold a job. I said, yes, I know. But, you know, it's not really, I'm not interested. And if I'm not interested, I can't write it.
Will Raymond get his own series or?
Oh, never.
Never?
He's a sociopath, you know?
We know that, but we want to find out more about Raymond.
You know, either you know, you eat it, fuck it, or kill it, or maybe all three, you know? I mean, it's like, you know, there's no shades of gray with Raymond. He's, you know, it's like he's good in the novel, but on his own, you know, I mean, I would have to be another kind of writer, you know, like, mm-hmm. like Iceberg Slim could get away with that, you know, but not me. Okay, here's one of them.
One thing I enjoy about your books is that your characters have quite a bit of humanity to them. I'm thinking of Socrates Fortlove, for example. Mm-hmm. And yes, he's done some rough things in his life, and but there's an intelligence, you know, I mean, he's named after a philosopher. But there's a depth and a connection to, you know, how the people in the community live. And then you weave in all of these different characters, the families, for example. There's a, as I recall in one of the books, a Native American child that he, is it Easy that adopts? I've read it so long ago.
Easy adopts Jesus, you know, which is, yeah.
There
yeah.
you go. And I don't know, I just wondered if you wanted to speak about those interplays between people, and even in Little Green, you know, there's... a mixing of the hippies, the white experience, and mm-hmm. black people, and what they learn from each other. I just wondered if you wanted to speak.
Well, you know, I'll answer the question, but like, you know, one time I was on a radio show, and I was here, a young woman was interviewing me, and she was saying, well, you know, what do you think about the conflict between blacks and Jews, you know? The antipathy, the what's going on between them today. And I said, well, you know, my experience of blacks and Jews is, you know, my mother and father, and you could see what came from that, you know, antipathy, you know. I mean, like, and then she said, well, yeah, I know, but I said, well, you know, really, the problems of blacks and Jews is you. Huh. And she said, well, what are you talking about? I said, well, you know, because... the news is always talking about, you know, they need to, you know, sell commercials, you know, they need to, you know, sell airtime, they need to gather an audience, you know, in order for them to have, you know, their life, their money, you know. And, you know, and so you talk about all the terrible things that happen. I know all these wonderful things that are happening, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, people talking about, you know, blacks and Chicanos or Koreans and everybody like we don't like each other, like we don't get along, like we weren't raised together here mm-hmm. in this city. In this city, you know, like there are a lot of cities that are naturally segregated, and LA is segregated according to class, but as far as race is concerned, they've been building the city so fast since 1946, they don't have time to choose who works with who. So my parents' friends were always, you know, Chinese and Korean and Mexican and white and black and Jewish and all the different religions. And it was, you know, and you know, 9 out of 10 people get along, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, at least on the surface, they get along. Hey, how you doing today, Joe? You know, maybe I don't want to go home with you, but how you doing today? You know, that's all I need. I just need you to smile at me and say hello. You don't have to take me home. I don't even want to go home, you know, with you. I mean, you know, and I think that my books reflect that experience.
Yes.
To talk about how people get along together, how people share lives together, how our lives come together and change each other and make each other and let us understand things. You know, like there's somebody in Kandahar who has more trouble than I do, and I should remember that. I don't have to go to Kandahar, but I should remember that, you know.
Beautifully said.
We have one more question.
When you write, do you work on the same thing every day until, like, you're finished, or do you write, like...
As close as I can. Okay. So, for instance, I start writing on novel A. I'm writing. I finish it. First draft, second draft, third. Send it to my editor. Okay, that's going to take 2 months. Mm-hmm. So the next day, I start writing novel B. I'm writing.
This is 46 books.
And then, like 45 days later, I get novel A back. And I say, and it with some suggested changes, which I usually argue with and don't make. But I have to read the book and look at. And so then I finish with that, send A back, finish with B, send it in, start working on C. You know, start writing, right. And then I get B back. You know, so it go that. So there's a kind of thing. With usually, large stretches of time, I'm working on one book. Sometimes I have to break off and do something else, but then I come back again to do that because I think that getting that deeply into your unconscious, you need to be thinking about the same thing. And if you start jumping all over the place, so does your mind, and you start making like kind of misconnections, bad connections.
Okay, well, like, I write songs and spoken word pieces, and I'll have one idea about maybe this person or this situation, and then I'll have, an idea about another person or situation or something like that. So I'm not just thinking about one thing all the time, so when my mind goes here, I'll write about that. And then, like, when it goes somewhere else, then I'll write about that. But you think it's a good idea to just focus on one thing until it's completed?
You know, like, I wouldn't tell you what to do. However, a great thing to do about that is to experiment with it. Mm. So, like, take a week and work on one piece. And at the end of that, take a week and work on another piece. And then see if what you get out of that is better than what you were getting before, because what you're getting, that your process before might be the right process. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't try to correct it. When I was answering a question about what I do, I was talking about what I do. I'm not saying you should do that, but I'm just saying how that works. But the best way to do it, especially if you're doing something which is not taking you like a year, let me try this for a week or a month or whatever and see how it works. And if it's good, I'll do it. And if it's not good, maybe it works in some things and not in others.
Hearing from this nice young lady makes me think about a time before I'd written a book that I came to an Aloud program. It was Suzanne Laurie Parks. And I asked her a question. And that's what's so special about this programming is the idea that people in the community and burgeoning artists get a chance to speak one-on-one with, the best that this country has. And my interchange with Suzanne Laurie Parks helped spur me on and to writing my first book. And I say all of that to say this program is brought to you guys by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. I am on the board. I'm a big believer. I'm a big supporter. It not only funds this incredible programming, it provides live homework help for students at any time who can get online and speak with somebody 24 hours a day to get help with their homework. It's putting computers in different branches. The work that's being done by the foundation is incredible. And I ask you guys to take a moment when you leave here to speak with representatives from the foundation about how you can become a member and support this wonderful programming and the great work of the foundation. So thank you guys, this was wonderful. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.